So I was doing a show there, and I was backstage, and the owner of the place came up to me, and he goes, hey, Joel, just so you know, out in the audience tonight, there's about 30 wounded warriors. And I'm like, that's awesome. I cannot wait to say hi. Thank you so much. And I'm about to walk on stage, and a waiter basically punches me in the chest, and he's like, there's wounded warriors in the audience tonight. And I'm like, just heard, very excited. I'm going to go say hi to them. Thank you. Then I'm on stage, and the opening comic is licking my ear to tell me, he's like, there's wounded warriors. And I was like, yes, I heard. Did you guys think I had a stroke? Yes, I know. I'm going to say hi. What's going on? And so then, so I say, ladies and gentlemen, there's wounded warriors here tonight, and there's this great, wonderful ovation. Everyone's clapping. It was a really cool moment. And I have always had a question for the wounded warriors, and I thought to myself, this is the right time, right?
Little column A, little column B.
First of all, I just want to tell you what a great show you got. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you, thank you. What do you want to talk about?
Hey, did I tell you guys I got a goat?
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
So I said, Wounded Warriors, thank you for coming. Thank you for your service. Thank you for being here. I have a question for you. Is there someone in your group who is perhaps, on average, way less wounded than the rest of you? Like, maybe his name is Gary, and Gary just got winged in the thumb or something. But Gary shows up to all the events. And Gary wears all the t-shirts, and he's got all the bumper stickers, and he takes all the photographs, and you've got a traumatic brain injury, and it's beginning to piss you off. Is there someone in your group like that?
Good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. Lots of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, although that may be a unfortunate turn of phrase tonight. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, veterans issues, and all that kind of stuff. Tis I, Dave, along with Rodbo.
Hello.
Good to see you again. See, I told you we'd do this. I feel like people didn't believe me when I said that.
Well, we're here.
I'm dead. I'm dying, but I am here. And God, I don't know what this plague is. It can't be the coronavirus.
I certainly hope not.
Well, it's not here yet, right?
Well, I'm not in Washington.
Well, if the coronavirus was here, wouldn't Tony Romo have to, couldn't you just call the Tony Romo hotline and he would tell you what to do?
I don't know about that.
I like Tony Romo. I hate the Dallas Cowboys. I hated Tony Romo when he was playing. But I like him as a sportscaster. I like him. And there's discussion now that he's going to be the Monday Night Football color guy.
Really?
And I'm okay with that. I'm as okay with that as I am with the Star Space Defense Force logo.
Oh, yeah, that logo.
I'm fine with it. I don't know what. Do people actually think that Donald Trump went into a room somewhere and went, gee, how can I rip off Star Trek with this logo? Is that what they actually think? Because that's the way they're acting.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't a team of people, you know, researching and planning for a specific amount of time. It was Donald Trump. He did it.
Right. Trump looked at Star Trek and went, we'll just take that because it's the greatest logo of all time. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I do know that I want to be an E7. I'm an astronaut. I think that's kind of cool myself, but there you go. So, I was telling Rod a few minutes ago, I feel like crap. I don't know what this is, but it floored me. So we recorded last Monday night, right?
Yeah.
Monday night we got done roughly 8 o'clock, if I remember right.
Yes, it was.
So I got everything done, downloaded, re-uploaded the show for the Facebook video and the YouTube video and did the podcast portion, got everything uploaded. I was in bed by 9 o'clock, and by 11 o'clock I was dying. I mean, the fever had hit and so my son had this. So I just assumed I got it from him because in the last 2 weeks he has missed all but 2 days of school. Three of them were Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that 2 weeks ago were snow days. Then they went to school. Then Friday he was sick. Monday was a holiday. And then he was out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday with this illness again. And I tell you, it's been a long time since I've had a fever like that. I mean, I don't know. Fevers. I mean, I don't want to get too disgusting here, but man, when it finally broke, I was a happy camper. Let's put it that way. But now I've got this chest thing going and it's hard to breathe.
It's, yeah.
As you can see, I'm coughing every kind of seconds, but I have absolutely no confidence that it's going to be any better tomorrow. So I told Rodbo, we'll go tonight. And if it is the coronavirus, then I'll get some beer tomorrow. And
there you go.
That'll solve it, right? That's,
oh, yeah.
That's the rule.
A little lime, a little salt.
Why do they do that? Why do you have to put a lime in a Corona?
You're asking the wrong person, because we were on the microbrew show. You know, that it was all about better beer. And Corona was not on that list. So,
well, I can't imagine it would be, but I'm still curious. I know what it does for tequila, and I know, you know, you're mixing a margarita, but I don't know why you would do that for beer.
No, it obviously augments the flavor somehow, and maybe it makes it more palatable.
Maybe it covers it.
Yes, covers it.
That's the only thing I can figure. Any beer you have to put a lime in,
you can't taste the urine smell.
Corona, if you'd like to sponsor the show, you can get us at dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. Can't guarantee we'll. That's the other thing. People have been asking me all week. I've been doing some consulting work for other podcasts, and it's like, well, how do we make money? Is it not on a podcast? You
know? No.
but Joe Rogan makes millions. Okay.
We actually made some beer on the Elevangelist show.
I think in the entire. See, I started doing the show in February of 2015, and I think in that entire time, I've made maybe $100. Maybe.
Hmm.
So, that doesn't include, you know, some other stuff that went on from a business donation, but I mean, that's just advertising, $100, and it's like, it's just not worth the hassle, man. It's just not worth it. Which is not what we were going to talk about tonight.
No.
So... I don't remember. I think I sent you this out of the blue last week, where this quote about Pete Buttigieg. Did you know we're like 13 days, 12 days from Iowa?
Seriously?
Yeah. Is that hard to believe?
This year's flying by.
Iowa, the caucus in Iowa, the Iowa cockeye, the rock eye cockeye. There's all kinds of nicknames for it. It's coming up real soon. And this is, of course, the traditional kickoff. This, along with New Hampshire, the traditional kickoff to the presidential brouhaha that we'll see a person possibly elected to the presidency of the United States. We can't say definitively anymore, because it seems like just because we have an election doesn't mean we have to pay any attention to it. At least that's the way it seems to me. So the Hawkeye Cockeye is bizarre. You know how this works?
Go ahead and explain it to me.
So that would be a no, right? Nobody knows how this thing works. So they go in rooms all over the state. They have these precincts, and I'm going to oversimplify this because, frankly, I don't care that much. But what they do is they go in these rooms, these gymnasiums and cafeterias and whatnot, and in these rooms, they draw a bunch of circles on the floor. And the circles then have names in them of the candidates. Okay?
Okay.
So then the people who show up for that caucus, all they have to be is registered Democrats, go stand in the circle that they want to vote for. And then the various circles plead, argue, debate, beg people to move to the other circles. Come over here. No, this is better. You don't want to be in that circle. You want to be in this circle, kind of thing.
It's like a strange game of Twister.
In a weird way, it kind of is. But there's a time limit on this thing. And so at the end of a certain amount of time, any candidate that doesn't have enough people in his circle, those people are told to go sit down.
Okay.
So they go sit down by the wall. And then the people in the other circles that had enough candidates start begging them to come stand in their circles, round two of this. And they keep doing this, and I have no idea how many times, until someone wins.
Okay.
By getting the most people in their circle. Now, there was a report back in 2008 that one of these caucuses, they only give you the big numbers at the end. They only tell you the big numbers right at the final thing. You know, Barack Obama got 52%, Hillary Clinton got, 46%, whatever. They don't tell you the individual. But apparently there were several of these caucuses where Barack Obama won by like one person moving to the other circle. So whenever somebody says, hey, your one vote doesn't matter, maybe it does. So this is how they do this, and they're getting ready to do it again. And of course it's raucous because it's a caucus, and I'm utterly amazed by the stupidity of the whole thing. I really am. Just like, are you serious?
How far does this date back?
I didn't look at it that much, but it's certainly been in my lifetime. Primaries have not been that. Primaries really came into their focus post-World War II. The primaries are really a reactionary measure. The problem with elections is that people might not necessarily vote the way you want them to, and primaries are a way of controlling. It's a way of the parties controlling who the people actually end up voting for.
That makes sense.
So in a way, certainly post the progressive era, which began in the 1900s, the primaries became a way for the parties to exert control over controlling the elections as to who would actually be in the election. And that way you didn't have, some crazy guy who was a billionaire or something with lots of his own money able to stand up and go, hey, vote for me because these other people are nuts. And it kind of kept that from happening. See, right? I mean, that was the idea. The problem is, of course, that the states all passed laws saying that, your delegates are bound, they're faithful. Yeah. And that may not be the case now because the Supreme Court's going to look at that. The parties are panicked right now. The parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, are both panicked about neither one of them really wants this case heard by the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court might say, yeah, faithless electors are fine. And boy, that would throw the cat amongst the pigeons, which has nothing to do with what I wanted to talk about tonight. But what I wanted to talk about tonight was Pete Buttigieg, who is the mayor of something, a city somewhere. I don't remember where. Some Midwestern flat corn intensive state.
And
he is a veteran, Rod.
Yes.
He is a veteran. Did you know this?
I did. He kind of reminds us frequently, I believe.
John Kerry used to frequently remind us that he served in Vietnam. And Pete Buttigieg is reminding people that. And it's kind of a weird thing. I talked about this last year. The three Democrat candidates that have military experience, none of them are doing particularly well in the polling, and certainly weren't at the time. At the time, they were all under 10%. I think Buttigieg has broken 10% now. But the other two, Tulsi Gabbard and Admiral Sleestak?
Sleestak.
He's out of the race now, so.
Lost in time.
I get that. I see what you did there. Yeah. At any rate, neither one of them are doing very well. And in fact, Tulsi Gabbard has decided to sue Hillary Clinton recently. I don't know if you saw this or not.
I did.
But she is actually suing Hillary Clinton. And in doing so, she has put out a statement that emphasizes her military service. She doesn't emphasize what that military service was, but she goes out of her way to say, I'm a patriot. I serve this country. Hillary Clinton is not, and yada, yada, yada. And that's, to a degree, I get that. In a way, I understand what she's saying, and I kind of support that. But at the same time, there's a certain level there of defensiveness about this that interests me, and it kind of interested you, I think, as we started talking about this through the week. And that is to the Democrat side of things. Now, we'll talk about the Republican side, assuming we have time, because we spent too much time on the Iowa caucus. But to the Democrat side of things, military service seems to have, what's the word for it? Like, it's like magic sauce or something.
Magic sauce.
Well, I guess that's the wrong way to put it. It's almost like, John Kennedy served. Lyndon Johnson served. Jimmy Carter served. So
it's like a badge.
It's a badge. It's it literally is a badge that says I'm a veteran, but it doesn't necessarily, at least on that side of things, seem to mean anything beyond that. Am I missing something here?
No, that seems about right. From what I gather is that the Democrats and the left just seem to, it's a way of being able to speak about a topic, and they're qualified because they have that badge, but they just, there's no value to it other than that.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think they look at it that way? What's different there?
Well, a lot of the left is against the military in general, but they use it, but they're still against the idea of the military. So they don't, I guess they don't really like to have that. Oh, what's the word for it? I wanted to say stain, but that's not quite right. But they just had this feeling that it's for this badge of honor that they wear, that they're trying to garner votes or attention with that.
Like a bobcat badge. Yeah, I got to get the bobcat before you can get the wolf before, or whatever, wolf before bobcat or whatever, and Weeblow and eagle and so forth and so on. I don't know, because so many of them don't have it. I wonder about the attitude, the mentality, because we on the right tend to see this way. Remember what we talked about last week. We tend to see the left as being anti-military. But is it really the left that's necessarily anti-military? Some days, I mean, I get in these conversations all the time with libertarians who are, you know, center right for obvious reasons. They are definitely against the military. And in fact, you know, we come from a long tradition in England of being opposed to standing military forces, standing armies. I was actually reading this week, it was fascinating, about the Stamp Act of 1765. Okay. This is really the focal point of the start of the American Revolution. This taxation without representation. You got to have these stamps. You got to have all this stuff. You know why they did that? Do you know why they wanted to put troops in North America?
Well, because they wanted to sway their opinions, wasn't it?
Well, that's part of it. But these troops that Lord Greenville was going to put in North America, he wasn't going to put in the 13 colonies. He was going to put them in Canada. Because the colonies, the American colonies, didn't need protection. They'd already proved that in the war of the French and Indian War. We'd already pretty much proved that we can take care of ourselves. We don't really need your help. But number two, Britain has this long-standing tradition of military service of, let's just call them hobnobs. That's the actual word they used to describe them, hobnobs. Rich young men who needed military service to complete their curriculum vitae. And so, because they didn't have standing armies in England, they needed to send them somewhere so that they could pretend to command troops. And so we'll put a bunch of armed services in armies in Canada, send these guys over there for a few years, let them do their thing. And then they come back, they're, you know, executives with the tea company. And now they've got their military service. And now all the doors in society are open to them. You see what I'm saying here? And I kind of think that's kind of by the way, in some ways, military service has come to be treated in the United States. And I think to some degree by both sides. Now, your general Republican, and again, I'm generalizing here, so as usual, when I generalize, I don't really care. Your general Republican tends to put military people up on a pedestal, which is also problematic to me. I mean, Joel McHale was talking about that. If you haven't seen the Joel McHale special, it's live from Pyongyang. It's hysterical. He's one of my favorite comics, by the way. And he talks about this wounded warrior thing where, isn't there somebody in your wounded warrior group that's just not, you know, not really wounded, you know, Lyndon Johnson, Silver Star kind of thing. And doesn't that just make you mad? And I struggle with this, Rod. I really do. I struggle with this. I'm 30% disabled, according to the VA. They are actually in the process. I have an appointment next month. They're supposed to be boosting that up and we're looking at it. And, you know, I left my knee on the hatch, third level hatch of USS Michigan. Wasn't shot at in combat. Yes, we were at 2SQ. Yes, technically it was the Cold War. Yes, technically we were on a war footing, but I'm not a combat veteran per se. So there are days when I get up and I think, am I really a disabled veteran? Am I really that? Am I even, you know, and then you get into the whole, am I really a veteran thing? I served, you know, some people served what, 78 to 81 or whatever, you know, they got in after Vietnam and left before Grenada. And so are they really veterans? And there almost is the stigma attached to it that I don't think the public always sees, but inside the veterans communities, we see it because this is an issue with veterans organizations. The World War II vets, especially places like VFWs and American Legions, they don't like the Vietnam vets because they lost, you know, and the Vietnam vets, they don't like the new guys because I don't know why, but there's this mentality that if you're not over 70, you just don't belong there. And it's strange to me, especially now that I'm where I am as the base commander for a veterans organization. I mean, it's like, I was having a conversation with my base the other day about Facebook and Instagram, you know? Yeah, great. We're all 60 years old and we're on Facebook. Those new people are on Instagram. We got to have an Instagram account. You know, it's like, I don't know, man. I struggle with it. I don't know if the public sees it the same way. I don't know if when you're looking at it, we look at this Buttigieg guy who has, let's just call it a marginal military career. His words, not mine. He was a glorified Uber driver. He said that, not me. Okay. So if you got an issue with it, should we take his military service seriously?
He served, but you know, what does that, I guess it's the value of the service. The service in and of itself deserves its respect. I mean, you enlisted, you spent time in the military. I'm not a military person, combat veteran. I'm not in a veteran at all. So from my point of view, yes, there's honor in serving, but also your character matters more, I think, than just what you did, Uber driver in the military.
Or, you know, team commander in Canada for the British government or whatever. I mean, and the problem you get into with somebody like Pete Buttigieg is that his service is, and I feel the same way. I'm frankly of the opinion that all service is honorable because you never know what's going to happen. I mean, you just don't know. And you enlist in the military thinking, well, I'm going to serve my 6 years and then go to college and whatever. And the next thing you know, some president's invading some country on the War Powers Act, and it turns into a 16-year ongoing thing and so forth and so on. And maybe you enlisted for patriotic reasons and the likes of that, and it turns into something completely different. I don't struggle with that. I don't have a problem with service across the board. If somebody was in the military, they were in the military. I mean, it's that simple. But there are some points that I look at as someone who went to basic training. Basic training was, Rod, I went in, I was just barely 18 years old. Okay, I came from a very sheltered family in Utah. We were not Mormon, but you know, the culture there.
So even more sheltered.
Yeah. And I mean, seriously, I had to learn a whole new language. I know the words were English, but they were used in ways that I'd never heard before. I had to learn all this stuff, and I had to do things that I'd never even imagined doing before, running 2.25 miles in 17 minutes or something, push-ups and sit-ups and burpees and all that crap. And it was hard. I mean, it really was hard. It was physically demanding, particularly because I was very young. And, you know, I know people look at me now and they go, geez, Dave, you're rotund. I wasn't back then, but I hadn't finished fully developing yet either. So, you know, there's a certain level of that. And then you go to sub school and you train with that and you have to do submarine escape training. Ho, ho, ho. I feel fine. I'll describe all that stuff someday. Then I had to go to A school and C school. And these things were emotionally draining and very physically challenging and emotionally challenging. And then you go to the submarine and then you're not the fleet. And then you're on a submarine that's on a fire and all this stuff. Well, Pete Buttigieg didn't do any of that. They called him up one day and said, hey, you want to be a captain in the Army? And he said, yeah. And they made him a captain and they put him in charge of driving cars. And it's like, well, wait, I drove cars sometimes in the military, but I didn't get to be a captain. And so there's sometimes where you kind of don't take it. you kind of look at it and go, well, is this guy just a rich hobnob from, you know, London who's looking to get this on his resume so that he can move up with the East India Tea Company, just like those people 250, 60 years ago were? Or is there actually something to this service? Should I be impressed by it on his presidential resume or not?
I'm impressed with people that actually serve in a combat role. I'm impressed with people that serve in general, but the same thing is, I'm not impressed with people trying to use that service to further their private career or public in regards to being a politician. It's just kind of what
Washington said. Washington said, you know, I don't want anything from my country. But I don't get that impression from these people, do you?
No.
And that's that's sad, I think. And as we come into Iowa, whoops, keep pushing the wrong buttons. I'm tired, folks. I'm not feeling good. As we come into Iowa in less than 2 weeks, do you think people are going to take any of those things into account? Do you think they're going to look at Tulsi Gabbard going, well, I'm a war veteran? You are. But,
yeah.
I mean, do you think they're going to look at any of that? Or is it just a
line item on a resume somewhere that people just will pass over?
On the Democrat side, what if these people were Republicans? Would it matter?
It would. I think Republicans pay more attention to that type of service. They're a little more astute, I think, in the actual those who serve and what they did in the military.
Well, didn't seem to hurt President Johnson. Lyndon Johnson got a silver star for being on an airplane that broke down. So things happen. It's a true story. You can look it up yourself. Well, I made it through, Rod. I'm sweating like a pig.
You did.
I made it through, and we'll, I feel like crap. So
thank you for your service.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm proud of what I did. I really am. Obnoxiously proud of it sometimes, but at the same time, I'm not that guy that got blown up when a Scud missile hit the barracks either. So I recognize that. There's a big difference between being 30% disabled and being the guy with no arms and no legs. So We'll keep that in mind. I got to get going. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman.
And I'm Rod.
And we will see you next time.
This is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.